Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Get off my world.
Listeners, and welcome back to Get Off My World, a podcast about Doctor Who. I'm Pat.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm Kelvin.
Get ready to be taken through five rounds rapid. We're going to talk about what we love and don't love about classic and new series Doctor Who. And as always, we start with our first round, Temporal Grace. It's in this round that we talk about things that we love about the world of Doctor Who. Josh, would you like to start?
Sure. Last episode, we talked a little about the podcast and how we do things. One of the things we said is that we record two episodes back-to-back, which we are doing tonight. So in order to prepare for this episode, I have consumed a lot of Doctor Who, and I got a little behind, and I consumed a lot of it in the last 3 days. If Doctor Who were a Thanksgiving meal, I'd be unbuttoning my pants. I don't know if that works, but that's the comparison I'm going with.
We're all Doctor Who bulimics here,
yes.
I think.
But in doing all that, in watching all the Doctor Who we're going to talk about in these next two episodes, I realized just how massive Doctor Who has become. Mm-hmm. Because I remember when I started watching Doctor Who, one of the things that drew me to it was that there was 20 whole years of this show and some Target novelizations of these stories, so it seemed like an endless supply of Doctor Who. Now we've got 50 plus years, we've got 26 years of the classic series, 10 years of the new series, we've got 15 years of audio, we now have lost episodes that have been found that we can watch, comic strips galore, and there doesn't appear to be any end in sight. And now it's not even linear anymore with audios and novelizations and retroactive regenerations. It's mind-boggling. And so I guess my Temporal Grace, it's just an appreciation of how terribly complicated Doctor Who now is and how much of it I will never get to.
I remember back in the 90s, it made the Guinness Book of World Records for longest-running novel series. And that was when it was off the air. I mean, there's certainly no competition for it left anymore. Kelvin, what about you?
Online, I saw it was sort of an essay about a thing Peter Capaldi said where Matt Smith said he definitely wanted to call back to like Patrick Troughton's performance and his performance of the Doctor. Well, Peter Capaldi apparently said like that he was going to try and bring back elements of all the other previous Doctors and have that be in his performance. And I remember reading that thinking like, wow, that's impressive, that's really challenging, and I don't know if I've seen that so much in what he's doing. But then I rewatched Hellbent, and there's the moment where it's revealed to Clara that the Doctor's spent, you know, billions of years in this thing. And she's horrified, and she goes to the Doctor and says, like, why did you do that? And the 12th Doctor just kind of looks at her with this, like, surprised and vaguely hurt expression and just says, I have a duty of care. And I just suddenly realized that's a 5th Doctor reaction. Like, oh no, what have I done? Why are you mad at me? You know, like kind of expression, which, you know, I never would have thought to see like the 5th Doctor reflected in something the 12th Doctor was doing.
Yeah.
Out of all the previous Doctors. Wow. Capaldi is doing it.
Well, for my Temporal Grace, I'd like to give a little thank you to my parents, who for Christmas this year, and to contextualize this for our listeners, I'm a 43-year-old grown man. But because I had Lego Dimensions video game with the Doctor Who expansion on my Amazon wish list, bless my parents, they bought it for me for Christmas. So I have not had a chance to play it yet, but I don't know. I suppose everybody in the world knows what this thing is, but you hook it up to, I've got a PS3. You have to assemble these Legos, and the initial set comes with, I want to say, Batman. And is her name Wildstyle from the Lego movie?
Yes.
I remember. And then I think there's somebody else, another few things in there. You assemble these Lego things, and you put them on this particular pad that comes with the box set, which and then it translates those characters into electronic versions that now populate the LEGO Dimensions universe and opens up new levels and things like that, and they're releasing expansions all the time. There's Portal and Scooby-Doo and Lord of the Rings, and I'm mostly just interested in the Doctor Who stuff, and so there was an expansion that, actually my sister Caitlin got this one for me. They all conspired to give me this. It's got the Peter Capaldi Doctor, K-9, and the TARDIS, and on pre-order, I have the Dalek and Cyberman one, too. So
well, there you go.
At some point in the next few weeks, I, a grown man, will be playing with all of these things in my living room.
Do you realize how big the Moon Dragon Lego figure would have to be?
Oh, yeah. Bigger than the city block, I'm sure. That's a lot of Legos. All right, so I think it's time, guys, for our special topics Dalek. This is the occasion where one of us surprises the others with a question about Doctor Who, and we have to do our best to answer it in the moment. So this time around, it's me. I've got a question for you guys. We're recording this 2 days after David Bowie died. Those people who know me know that I'm an enormous David Bowie fan. This was heartbreaking to me. And this question I actually had in mind months ago, but it's now become even more pertinent. Kelvin, I think you shared on either the Get Off My World Facebook page or maybe on my homepage or something like that, some interview with Peter Capaldi where he said that he wanted David Bowie to appear on the program.
Yeah.
And I thought, of course, that's the most magnificent idea ever. He had apparently been asked in the past.
Yeah.
It was requested that he play Sheriff's Jack.
Yes.
And Drazani, but it didn't work out. So, obviously, that's never going to happen now. Mm-hmm. But my question for you guys is, what rock star or musician would you like to appear or to have appeared on Doctor Who, and what sort of role would they play? And to put some parameters on this, let's say it's any time in the show's history, so from 1963 to the present day. If you want to do the Wilderness Years, we can think of, you know, if you want to get Nirvana and the Spice Girls in there, that's fine. We'll just say that the show was on the air in this alternate universe. So who would you like to appear on Doctor Who?
Well, I do know that there was a plan in the first Doctor era to have the Beatles show up as very old men. Like, it was the Doctor visiting the Beatles when they were like 80 or 90 years old or something. But it didn't work out in their scheduling.
They didn't think to just cast some old guys, old nobodies, and have them play the old Beatles? Because that would be a great
story. That would have been kind of hilarious to get some old British music hall actor. Put a Beatles wig on them.
Out-of-work Liverpudlians.
Yeah.
I could have put fake beards on.
Classic comedy, you know, 4 foot long. Wow, I'm really old beards.
Yeah. Yeah.
I keep thinking it would be great to see Tom Waits play like a desiccated master of some kind.
He has the voice.
But just by life. He didn't run out of regenerations. He just dragged himself into his corpse-like state.
Some regeneration of the master where he just kept drinking and smoking.
And so then when he says, we're going to have to go all the way back to the Civil War, he actually can get in a time machine and go all the way back to the Civil War.
You know, I got to learn to go first in all of these shout-outs because Tom Waits was exactly who I was going to talk about. It's no surprise he's my other favorite musician of all time.
Of course.
My thought is that Tom could have played I Am Foreman.
Nice!
Junkyard proprietor.
Yes!
An unearthly child.
He is a junkyard proprietor.
Yeah. He's got like a broken calliope back there somewhere. And he's like making percussive instruments out of broken old trams and railroad signs.
If I was doing any kind of film or television project and I needed a crazy junkyard proprietor, first item on the list, Tom Waits.
Well, I think it'd be wonderful, and he could, you know, he'd be a mysterious character. Like, who is this person? He's not really just an old American junk man.
Oh, yeah. You know? They could use, what's he building?
It's digressing a little bit, but Lawrence Miles did talk about I Am Foreman in the Interference novels.
Oh, yeah.
Turns out to be a Time Lord based on the Seven Faces of Dr. Lao, that old... that old novel he made into a movie with Tony Randall. He was traveling around in a circus with all of his regenerations with him at the same time. And that was, I'm sorry, that was a spoiler, I guess, for the people out there who haven't read Interference, which is quite a good book.
Someone was sitting there reading it while they were listening to this and just threw the book down in disgust.
Well, so you've stepped on my Tom Waits. Kelvin, do you want to jump on the Tom Waits bandwagon, or do you have Jimmy Buffett? You want to get Jimmy Buffett?
No. Maybe Devo as RoboCop.
Yes.
They probably wouldn't even have to change their hats.
Are we not men? We are RoboMen. That'd be perfect.
Yes.
Real Doctor Who just got that much more disappointing.
Okay, next round we are coming to the randomizer. And what we are going to be discussing here is the long-lost but relatively recently rediscovered Second Doctor story, The Enemy of the World. This is a story that I have wanted to see ever since I was a kid and got the cheap little paperback guidebook of the episodes. And I just thought the plot line of Enemy of the World sounded extra cool for some reason to my 10-year-old brain.
Did you guys ever read the Target novelization at all?
I never did.
I owned it, but did not read it.
I never read it either. So this was not just a lost episode, but like
this
I had no idea what this was about.
This is new,
other
fresh.
Than Salamander and that Patrick Troughton played him. That's all I knew.
Yeah, I knew a little bit more than that because, like Kelvin, I read a lot of these episode guides when I was growing up and you know, the Peter Haining books and stuff.
Yeah.
But there were still plenty of things in there that were surprising to me, not only on the plot level, but particularly just sort of the tone and the attitude. It's not very Doctor Who-y when you get down to it. It's much more in common with other 1960s spy shows, like Man from U.N.C.L.E. or Danger Man, or kind of science fiction-y Danger Man. But it's clearly playing on Cold War tensions that were existent in the 1960s, only it's elaborated into, there's a Mexican guy who's kind of the head of the world now, Salamander.
Yeah,
I think there's actually quite a bit to say about that. I'm wondering.
I have kind of a really bizarre theory about why he's Mexican, but we can get to that maybe later.
We won't forget to come back to that. I'm just wondering whether we should give a quick overview of the plot to people who may not have seen it.
I think we should give a quick overview.
Spoilers!
Okay.
So it's the near future.
Yep.
And that's all. No.
To some degree, that's all. It's a bit vague what the world looks like. There's clearly a little bit of an oppressiveness to the government, but it doesn't seem completely totalitarian.
There's still different nation states. We don't really see much of the rest of the world. We just kind of hear like, oh, this happened in North America or this happened in Australia, right? But Salamander he's not an elected dictator. He's
We don't really know what the heck his role is in the world government. Near as I can figure, he's like head of the agriculture committee.
Yeah.
Or something, because he seems to be all involved with the food production and the weird solar satellites to make plants grow in the night.
And he's got a pocket little kingdom. He's got his own police force.
Yeah.
He looks exactly like the Second Doctor, and that's the plot on which all of this hinges. Partly because revolutionary elements decide to use the Doctor for their own purposes because they don't like Salamander. Because Salamander presents himself as a figure of global peace, but he's actually an evil dictator type. And later on, it's revealed that, of course, Salamander is evil. In fact, he has a literal underground group of useful idiots who are below ground working machines that cause earthquakes and volcanoes to go off. But what they think that they're doing is... What do they think they're doing when they're starting all these earthquakes?
It's very unclear at first.
I thought it was like last gasp of the forces of freedom fighting international communism. Basically.
It's something like that.
Yeah. I gotta admit, I did not see that plot twist coming.
No, I didn't either.
Salamander gets into the weird bullet train elevator thing, which was actually a pretty cool effect. And then there are all these scientists wearing tablecloths. It's like a fairly ridiculous bit of 60s-era costuming. But yeah, they've been living under there for years, thinking they're the survivors of a nuclear war. Knocked me over with a feather. I had no idea that was coming.
It comes late in the story. It's like late episode 4. It's over the top and ridiculous and very Bondian in that way, but within the confines of the narrative, I think it works as a plot twist. It gives a reason for what's going on, but yeah, it's out of left field.
So what's your interesting theory about the Mexican-ness of Salaman?
I dimly remember this from when I was a kid, and you know, we had some kind of volcano unit in like third grade or something. A volcano just sprang up in Mexico like in the 40s. I can't remember what it's called, like Puquina or Picuna or something like that. Like literally, it was like some farmer is out plowing his cornfield. The earth cracks open and there's a volcano.
Holy cow!
And he was like, and he runs away and like the ash cone forms and there is a mountain there that wasn't there before.
Wow.
So you're saying this was ripped from the headlines.
So yeah, I was thinking like maybe in the public consciousness, Mexico just represented land of volcanoes.
Yeah.
So like there's and Salamander uses volcanoes for his plot.
Or could it be the only accent Patrick Troughton could do?
This is kind of this is a fairly interesting story for accents, I gotta admit.
Yeah.
The Australian guys actually almost sound more American than the employees.
I will say that there are so many odd little puzzling elements of this story that you do try to kind of make sense of it in that way. Like, why are there accents like that? Why is he Mexican? For me, it was, why is his name Salamander? And I thought for a while...
Well, they occasionally they pronounce it more like Salamander.
Salamander, yes, Salamander.
Which is a plausible Hispanic name, I think, but I could be wrong.
Well,
it's probably just because, it sounds like a slimy thing, and he's a slimy evil guy.
Well, here's my thing. But at first I thought, is it supposed to be evocative of Salamanca? But he's not Spanish, he's Mexican. So now I think it's almost certainly a reference to Scaramanga, the villain from The Man with the Golden Gun, which had just come out 2 years earlier. The novel.
The novel had.
And he's a very James Bondy villain. He's not like Scaramanga. He's more like Hugo Drax from Moonraker, where everybody thinks he works for the British Rocket Group or whatever Drax is supposed to be doing in Moonraker, but he's actually a secret evil guy. And of course, like all Ian Fleming villains, he's not English. Doctor Who is not afraid to make British villains. They do it all the time.
Yeah.
But here, for some reason, maybe the James Bondian-ness of him forced them to make him a different nationality.
It was interesting that the Doctor really needed proof. We didn't see some of those like racial stereotypes where they come in and go, he's got an accent, he's a bad guy.
Yeah.
He was not going to help harm Salamander until he knew for sure he was a bad guy. And usually the Doctor's quick to fight any regime. Regime change comes naturally to him.
There was reason to be cautious, too, because as it turned out, and this sounds like a bit of script rewriting on the fly to me, the guys he hooks up with originally, Giles Kent, turns out to be a traitor at the end.
Yeah.
So the guy who convinces the Doctor to go up against Salamander, Salamander is evil, but he's also evil.
It's just a power play thing on his part.
Yeah. And then on the flip side of that, you've got Donald Bruce,
yes,
who's one of the long lines of Doctor Who brutish secret policemen.
Yep.
And he winds up being the Doctor's ally.
Genuinely happy to see that. You know, Bruce shows up and my eyes just start rolling like, oh god, this is the most stereotypical Doctor Who villain I've ever seen. He's dressed all in black, he's got the rough voice, and he's suspicious and angry at everyone, and I'm like, oh god. But he turns out to be a decent person who's just doesn't have a lot of people skills.
Like a lot of people in the NKVD.
Yeah.
In contrast with Salamander's security guy, I don't know his name, but he was in...
Oh, Milton Johns. He's in the Android Invasion?
Android Invasion,
yeah.
Yes.
He's a super hateful jerk.
He really is.
The Salamander's food taster gets shot by one of... Oh, we forgot his name. Milton Johns's men. And she's lying there dying, and he still feels compelled to, like, pull out a gun and stick it in her face and, like, tell me his name!
Yeah.
I was thinking, like, that is one of the most evil things I've seen in Doctor Who. I mean, she's clearly dying, and he's still threatening her with, like, gunfire to the face death.
He was also a Santaran in The Invasion of Time.
I recognize him immediately.
You could be forgiven for not recognizing him.
That strange potato head.
So there's a lot of recognizable Doctor Who guys in this. Well, it's directed by Barry Letts, which was kind of interesting for me to watch. Later go on, of course, to be the main guy on Doctor Who in the Third Doctor era. But not only Milton Johns, but we've got Dennis, the political opponent of Salamander, who gets purged. Yeah, and that's George Pravda. He had a long career. He was in The Mutants, but we mostly know him from The Deadly Assassin.
Yeah.
But I wanted to talk about Faria. Is it Faria?
Faria.
And she's one of the few women of color with a speaking role in all of classic Doctor Who. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Her name's Carmen Monroe, and she turns out to be kind of a big deal. I looked her up. She's not only an accomplished stage actor, but according to Wikipedia, she was one of the founders of Talawa, the UK's leading black theater company, which she established in 1985 together with Mona Hammond, Inigo Espagel, and Yvonne Brewster. And as of 2007, she has an OBE.
Wow.
So, just in this odd food taster role, this very interesting woman with a long career. Who knew?
She's a hero in this. She sacrifices herself.
She's a hero, and it's a strangely prominent role for someone whose job is food taster.
yes, it is.
And I think that's partly to deal with the poisoning subplot. They had to have a lot of food-related scenes, and I hate saying this, but it gave Victoria something to do. to be the kitchen help. And this is the one point where the story where it really kind of bogged down for me was the comedy chef. the crabby chef. No one's going to like my soup. My soup is ruined.
You surprised me, Kelvin. I would have thought that would be your favorite part of this. It's the comedy cook. He did seem like he was going for a spinoff.
I wasn't against the concept of the comedy cook. It just seemed like it was
a little overseasoned.
He's overseasoned.
So we should probably wrap it up, but there are a few other things I wanted to mention about this, because overall I loved Enemy of the World. I thought it was terrific.
Me too.
It's very weird and not terribly Doctor Who-y, but every bit of it, Comedy Cooks accepted, was pretty fun.
It's early enough in Doctor Who's history that, there wasn't like this super firm template. This is what a Doctor Who story must look like.
Yeah, it's fun to see it parallel other television of the era. It feels like Man from U.N.C.L.E., it feels like James Bond, and it does that in kind of a fresh way, because those things are fresh in the public consciousness, mm-hmm. not old, creaky cliches. I was always also happy to see the stock footage of volcanoes.
Always a fan.
Show up in Inferno. I'm a big stock footage fan, of course. I was a little disappointed, I will say, on a racial level, that they actually used bronzer on Patrick Troughton when he's playing Salamander. And in fact, the Doctor wipes bronzer from his face when he's pretending not to be Salamander anymore.
Oh, you're right.
I'm like, was that really necessary?
I saw that they gave him some eye makeup.
Some eye makeup?
To give him some, dark villainous...
Some swarthiness.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, right? It's just that kind of...
Yeah, the swarthy villain.
The signifier of swarthiness.
Yeah, it has some trappings of that era, but overall I would say it's far more sensitive than... other things.
A lot of other things.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
well, that's why I single it out, because it was, I thought, superfluous.
And yeah.
It mostly, it was particularly racially disgusting. and I'm glad that we finally got a scene between the Doctor and Salamander at the end, because I was kind of worried that we're never going to see the two of them together. I thought Salamander got blown up in the underground thing.
Yeah.
And but no, eventually Salamander runs into the TARDIS, and you get Patrick Troughton doing a kind of his amazing rubbery face against his other rubbery face expression. It's a fun ham off between
and it's
the two of them.
Well directed. It's intense for that.
Yeah, it's pretty
Doctor
scary.
Who, and he gets ripped out into the time vortex.
And I was starting to compose fan fiction in my head of like Salamander in the time vortex. What happened? But apparently that's already been done. There's like a couple novels or audio stories that involve like what happened to Salamander. He gets absorbed into some group consciousness in the vortex or something.
Oh, perhaps one of those things from the novel Spiral Scratch. We should talk about sometime.
My running complaint with 6-episode-long stories is, the rather predictable. They're too long. That should have been 4 episodes.
Fair.
I didn't really feel like this was overly long.
There was a lot going on.
I felt like it warranted 6 episodes.
You wanted it to be 8 episodes.
No, I don't. I really didn't. Yeah, it felt like this is a 6-episode story.
Yeah, it had a lot of plot twists, a lot of characters. It's rare in Doctor Who that there's a, at least classic Doctor Who, there's a plot twist you don't see coming. Mm-hmm. And both the bizarre underground lair and Bruce becoming a good guy, the other guy becoming a bad guy. And it did upturn some of the ethnic implications there, too, as in we see the food taster as a valiant hero, not just a servant. The heroic-seeming white guy as the rebel leader is actually just as evil as Salamander. So they turn a lot of tables on a lot of different characters. It keeps it interesting. And it's also really funny because so many Second Doctor episodes are lost. I forget how funny Patrick Troughton is and how funny he is with Jamie.
Yeah.
And there's so many. I mean, obviously the great beach scene when he comes running out to go skinny dipping. And that's just kind of goofy, funny Doctor stuff. And it's funny. But what makes it a highlight is the pleasure Jamie has at watching him jump into the ocean. There's a shot of Jamie just laughing like it's the funniest thing he ever saw.
I really did enjoy the Doctor cavorting in the surf. It's like the Doctor should do that more often. Just strip down to his skivvies and just pee.
This is only the second Patrick Troughton story that we've done for this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to make a point of revisiting some more because I love him. I think he's terrific.
And now round 4, Revenge of the Minisode. That's right, we are back with one more new series discussion, The Husbands of Riversong, this year's or last year's Christmas special.
All the Husbands of Riversong?
I think it's implied. It's like the Infinity Doctor. It's the Infinity Husbands. I'm sure she's...
Yeah, I'm fairly sure River has gotten around a bit.
They will be chronicled in books and audio now.
Well, I'll start. I don't know what I think of it, because so much of it is just my attitude going in. I mentioned this last year, the Christmas special, too, right? You know, I look at it with a sour attitude, and I think it's terrible. I look at it with a... a more compassionate attitude, and I really enjoy it. I just watched it again this afternoon. It essentially breaks down into two things. One, a long MacGuffin run around with a diamond in a guy's head, and then a guy's head in a bag. And it's mostly played for comedy, and a lot of that is, I thought, very funny, particularly all the stuff that Peter Capaldi was doing. He is absolutely brilliant. His comedic timing here, and just like the deadpan delivery of all his stuff, I thought was terrific. A lot of the other stuff, I don't know. So anyway, that's part one. And then part two is the reason for this episode in the first place, which is the long conversation between the Doctor and Riversong. It takes like the last 5 minutes or so of the episode, and might be the last time that she appears on the television program. We don't know.
It should be.
Should be.
This is a great ending for her.
It is. I don't think anyone's surprised to hear me say I've never been a big fan of River. I liked her when she was called Benny Summerfield, I guess. But never cared for her terribly much on the show. But if it had all been written and delivered like that last exchange between the two of them, then I would have had a much different attitude. Because I thought that was tremendous. Mm-hmm. It was a really great... I got quite verklempt. That's not easy for Doctor Who to do to me, as we all know. The rest of it was more of a mixed bag, but I've been going on for a while. What did you guys think?
I pretty much agree with you, Pat. The comedy is a little hit and miss. I thought Capaldi was the winner in the comedy war. And there's something to be said about maybe not casting a bunch of big, well-known comedians who overdo the comedy. Because Capaldi seemed to understand the balance between that this is sort of a swashbuckling bit of light adventure fare with comedy, whereas the other guest cast seemed to treat it as just a scene-chewing sketch. And so some of the same type of jokes when delivered by Capaldi, for me, really hit, and when delivered by the wacky comedy guest stars sort of went wah, wah, wah.
Yeah.
But I actually enjoyed it way more than I thought, and I was really impressed by the wrap-up of Riversong's story, and I did not expect that. I also think it's Moffat going back and ironing out some inconsistencies with Riversong and getting her personality to go from the sort of sociopath they developed during the Matt Smith run into the gentler, seemingly kinder Riversong we first are introduced to in Silence in the Library. So I felt like it came really nice full circle. And I will admit, I don't know what that bastard Moffat has done to me, but I also was a little teary at the end. I was like, why'd they cut away before they kissed? I mean, I was like a 12-year-old girl by the end of it.
Did you have a stroke, Josh?
I don't know what happened to me.
But
they had the chemistry that Matt Smith never had with Alex Kingston.
They just seemed like, I mean, the 11th Doctor and River just seemed like, I don't know, like party buddies or something. You know, in the big restaurant scene, the 12th Doctor and River really seemed like, no, these are people who had a relationship. These are people who were legitimately involved with each other and had legitimate feelings.
Yeah, Capaldi's performance in that final speech when they're standing on the balcony is better than I thought I would ever see a performance in Doctor Who. It is, like, extremely nuanced and layered. I was really surprised.
I also want to point out for special praise the interesting up and down that goes with River pouring her heart out to the bad guys. Oh, the stars don't care about you, just like the Doctor, and blah, blah, blah. It's a long, very, very purple, but well-delivered, impassioned speech. It's way over the top, it's way overwritten, and under normal circumstances, I'd be a little bit like, it's trying to do too much with too little there. But to have it immediately undercut by the Doctor, it's like, well, maybe I should ask the stars for advice, or just like constantly, just like needling her right away. Retroactively made it seem much sweeter. It was like, oh, here's a relationship between two people who have known each other for a long time.
Again, how much of it is that Alex Kingston and Peter Capaldi are age appropriate?
That can be part of it. Some actors have more chemistry than others. It's also Moffat's scripts for River Song with Matt Smith made her a far more shallow, less believable character than she was portrayed in this episode. Here he portrayed her as this person that had some depth, and the stuff on the outside, the sweetie and all that stuff, was sort of a bantering veneer. Whereas it's that bantering veneer is all we got during Matt Smith's era, for the most part.
Well, I can never figure out what was going on during those seasons anyway. It's like, what? Yeah. He's dead? Yeah. They're married? What? What's going on here? I'm going to go watch Star Trek.
I feel bad for Matt Smith, though. I hope he didn't see that scene. And Capaldi also gets the great scene of playing the bigger on the inside shock.
Yes.
That is appropriately overdone. I mean, he does everything but, like, faint. He just...
I really liked... I don't know how many more ways I could say it and actually make it interesting to our listeners, but I just really liked his performance throughout. That wonderful sequence where she's knocked unconscious on the floor of the TARDIS, and he just casually, like, okay, I'm in. I flip this switch forward, I flip it back, and I walk out. Here's this crashed thing. It has the exchange with the rescue guy, which is, I think, a very sweet thing. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, I don't think you're going to find anybody worth saving, but thank you for trying.
Yeah.
And here's a couple $1 billion or whatever it is. Go build a restaurant over there. Goes back into the TARDIS, flip switch, go out, make the reservation, go back in, flip switch. It's just so calm and casual. The body language there, I just thought it was brilliantly done. Yeah, I could watch that last 15 minutes over and over again. And I don't say that about a lot of new Doctor Who.
I will say that it's a Christmas episode that didn't feel like, oh, we have to make some huge statement about the spirit of Christmas. It was a comic episode where I actually largely liked the comedy. I mean, you got the wacky dictator with the huge robot body. and then it surprises me by actually being poignant at the end.
I do want to say it has one of my favorite Moffat lines, and again, it's Capaldi's delivery of it, and it's perfect for Capaldi's Doctor, but when Riversong says, "Does sarcasm help?" and Capaldi just looks so wistful and says, "Wouldn't it be great if it did?"
Shout out for the sign on the TARDIS, "Carolers will be criticized."
I think we loved it.
I enjoyed it.
Loved much of it.
I just wish they'd kissed.
You guys, it's time for our fifth and final round, The Death Zone. Now, you guys, listeners, this is a double-length Death Zone. We'll be talking about one part of it on this episode, and the second part of it on our next episode. Here's where the spoiler warning comes, because even describing why we're putting these two together could technically count as a spoiler. So, this Death Zone, we are going to be pairing the Gary Russell novel Spiral Scratch with the new series of audio adventures starring Colin Baker called The Last Adventure. And, spoiler, we do this because they both concern different versions of the regeneration of the Sixth Doctor. Gary Russell's novel comes first in 2005. Thank you. And The Last Adventure just came out a few months ago. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about Spiral Scratch first. Now, Gary Russell is, we haven't really talked much about him on the podcast so far, but he's a big deal. He's a big figure in Doctor Who and has been for a long time.
Especially in the novel.
Especially in the novels.
Well, he was the original executive producer of the Big Finish audios for the first, you know,
from
5 or 7 years.
1998 to 2006.
Yep.
He was also the editor of Doctor Who magazine from 1992 to 1995. He's been script editor on the Sarah Jane Adventures and on Torchwood. He co-produced and directed the two animated David Tennant miniseries, The Infinite Quest and Dreamland. And he's written over 20 Doctor Who Universe novels, as well as innumerable comic strips, including the inaugural 10th Doctor and Martha strip from IDW Comics some years ago. So he's as involved in Doctor Who as anyone ever has been, but his profile has kind of faded a bit since the new series debuted, because he hasn't been involved with the main line of Doctor Who stuff since then. I'm not going too much on a limb to say that he's generally regarded as kind of middle of the road. Not terribly exciting, his adventures.
He's a very traditionalist when it comes to Doctor Who.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that surprised me when he was running the audios is how many experimental stories he brought in, and writers like Rob Shearman, who did very different things from what you associate with Gary Russell. So even though his taste runs very traditional, he, as a producer, made sure there was space and room for other types of stories and other voices, at least in the Big Finish range. Arguably, I think the best Big Finish audios were during his reign.
Okay.
But yes, as a novelist, he is not always that much beloved.
I don't know if I've read any of his novels before now. I've certainly heard audios, and I've read quite a bit of the comic strips over the years that he's done. I think this is the first novel of his that I'm familiar with. So what did we think? Well, broadly speaking, plot. Let's talk about how it goes.
It will be really broad.
Very broad.
Because
it's a pretty detailed plot.
It's all over the place.
Yet it's also really simple, as in there is a giant monster who lives at the center of realities or in the vortex,
in the vortex.
It's really unclear, and is feeding off the destruction or absorption of alternate timelines and realities. So it's all about splintered universes, realities. It sort of changes throughout the novel exactly what they're talking about, whether they're timelines or whole universes or what.
Yeah.
But that's basically it. So the book plays with a lot of alternate timelines, alternate Earth histories, alternate other planet histories, and mainly lots of alternate versions of the Sixth Doctor and Mel.
Yeah. One of my favorite elements is the Silurian version of Mel from a different
yes.
timeline. Is a half Silurian Mel. Her mother was a reptile woman, and father, well, one or the other.
One or the other.
Traveling with the Doctor. This book is a hot mess, you guys. It's totally a hot mess.
Oh, you mean like structurally?
Yeah.
Prose?
it's a good example of the kind of thing that was coming out in the Wilderness years, because it's got really deep continuity references, very buried stuff.
Because there isn't any other Doctor Who media happening. It tries to cover every conceivable thing the Doctor can do or might run into in 250 pages, which gets a little overly dense.
There's a real trend in those books, particularly the BBC lines, where things just keep escalating, and so increasing types of pseudoscience and universe-destroying things start cropping up with some regularity. It starts off in some tiny, distant key, and then before you know it, universe-eating eels and things. Oh, what the heck is going on? And here's this babble and this pseudoscience. There's also a kind of unfortunate tendency. This pops up more in the Virgin novels than the BBC ones, but it's still present here, to include some adult content that would never have made it onto the television show, at least the classic series. And there's something a bit gross about it.
I would agree. Do we really need to know much about Mel's sexual awakening? Probably not. And the weird dark subplot that she murdered her 18-month-old sister accidentally. It is weird, and
that really didn't add anything. to the story, except as like a weird identifier for which Mel from which universe you're talking to, like if they remembered having a sister or not.
Yeah, because some had sisters in some universe is, and some did not, and mm-hmm. some had accidentally killed their baby sister. I mean, mm-hmm. obviously it's just a way to backfill character in, mm-hmm. into Mel, because she never exhibited very much of it on, mm-hmm. during the short time she was on television. But there is something strange, isn't there, about, you know, writing a character portrayed by a living actress and, like, imagining their losing their virginity, or living in the Shag Palace.
The Shag Palace,
yeah. Yes. College. And this odd tragedy in her family background. I don't want to make too much out of it. It's a small part of a relatively long yeah. book, but it stands
it's
out
discord.
As a, yeah. kind of a clumsy way of...
I guess the thing that the most stuck out in the novel for me was, like, Mel and the Doctor don't seem to like each other.
They don't. None of them. None of the version.
They really don't seem to get along. They're endlessly irritated with each other's personality quirks, and I'm like, I don't understand why they're together.
Some of that he's riffing on the alternate universes where yeah. some Doctors get along better with Mel than others. I think the Doctor Prime, the televised Doctor, there's a lot of banter between them that seems a little negative, but I think underneath it, they're still fond of one another. Mm. I don't think it's to, like, Doctor and Perry levels. One of the strengths of this book is that Gary Russell captures the cadence of Colin Baker's
oh, yeah.
performance. The dialogue mm-hmm. for the Sixth Doctor, you hear Colin Baker
oh,
saying
yeah.
all this stuff. He really knows Mel, too, so that's, I think, part of why when we get to the Shag Palace and weird stuff with her and the greatest Mel quote ever, "Screw you, bitch," which I would pay anything to actually hear an audio version of this.
Bonnie Langford, we're looking
Bonnie
at you.
Langford just swearing up a storm. So those couple elements really seem weird because he so perfectly captures in other areas the TV performance of both Colin Baker and
yeah,
Bonnie
and stuff like... Well, I can't remember the specific thing, but like Mel just sort of like, "Were you drunk when that happened?" And the Doctor kind of looks down at his spats and like, "I don't recall."
Well, for whatever reason, in alternate media, Colin Baker, the Sixth Doctor, was the Doctor most likely to get drunk. Because I think in Eric Sayward's audio that he did during the hiatus in the 80s, that was on BBC, Slip Back.
Oh, yeah.
That has a whole riff with Perry again, trying to make the Doctor confess to being drunk at some other occasion. And I think there's at least one other drunken night of debauchery with the Sixth Doctor.
The Sixth Doctor is kind of the most unpredictable and unstable one.
Yeah.
You know, he could have a binge.
Overall, I liked this book a lot more than I anticipated.
Mm-hmm.
Part of it is Gary Russell just trying to throw his arms around the world. It's got a big scope, even mm-hmm. if it doesn't always work. It starts in 16th century England, mm-hmm. which is probably my favorite part of the book. It's pretty well crafted. It's interesting characters. It's got a fascinating setup. Which unfortunately doesn't lead
I know.
Really anywhere
I
at all.
I was like, when are the green kids going to come back?
Well, they're yeah. the Lampreys.
Yeah, no, I mean, it eventually...
You find out at the end, but it doesn't really
yeah.
pay off.
Yeah, a sentence or two does explain
yep.
The connection. But, I mean, from there, the book goes to Romania and England in 1947, and then England again a few years later in the 1950s. Tons of alternate universes, including one where there's a global Roman Empire, mm-hmm. which I like to think is... the same one from the Fourth Doctor comics,
yes.
The Iron Legion.
Yes.
The robots, yeah. But
there, I just want to give Gary Russell some props for not doing a sort of generic, darker version of the Doctor. Mm-hmm. I thought his one-eyed, more battle-scarred version of the Sixth Doctor was actually pretty nuanced and subtle. He was very different from the one we know.
I do recall saying something like when Colin Baker first accepted the role, his idea for the Doctor was... an all-black outfit. I don't recall if he mentioned a facial scar or not. That was kind of that alternate universe Doctor, that was the first thing I thought of, like, well, this is what Colin Baker would have wanted to play.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If he had a choice.
The other thing I would like to mention about this book, to put it in some sort of nerd Doctor Who fandom historical context, Gary Russell is sort of continuity obsessed or was.
Mm-hmm.
And some fans who are continuity obsessed want to make every media work together. But his sort of continuity obsession took him to the other realm where he really wanted to make every form of Doctor Who media take place in its own universe. So this book, in some ways, is his version of trying to make that official and canonical. So at the end, we have the big finish Doctor with Evelyn Smythe. We have the comic strip Doctor with Frobisher.
Yeah.
We even have his real-time audio he did for the BBC as a separate timeline where Evelyn Smythe got this Cyberman virus, and he never wanted to, he never wanted to deal with it, and he said later that it happened in a separate reality. And so here he actually wipes them out of existence, so he's done with that story.
I did see that reading up online about this after reading it, like, oh, Cyber Evelyn was actually a thing.
Okay.
Yeah, this is at the very climax of the book, where the Doctor has decided to try to... The big evil worm thing at the center of the vortex is called the lamprey.
Yeah.
And what they're going to do is they're going to force feed it. They're going to give it too many alternate universe doctors for it to survive. And so doctors and companions from all over the multiple universes come, and they sacrifice their lives to blow up the lamprey, including, ultimately, Dr. Prime, the television version of Colin Baker, who is so drained from this experience that he passes out and on the floor of the TARDIS and wakes up looking like Sylvester McCoy.
Exactly. That's providing the regeneration part of the story.
Yeah, but that, I thought that was interesting stuff. All of those alternate universe doctors are wiped out here in this moment, including, if I'm remembering correctly, the Stranger is there.
They do mention that.
The Stranger is the Doctor Who with the serial numbers filed off version that BBV... VHS tapes and audio adventures were producing there for a little while, where the Doctor was hanging out with Ms. Brown instead, because they couldn't say Perry.
Yep.
And they couldn't say the Doctor, so he's the Stranger, but he appears here too.
Yep.
I'm like, this is amazing. It's really trying to cast your hands around everything and bring it in not only to the television version of the Sixth Doctor, but essentially every version of the Sixth Doctor ever. Except I think the Big Finish one survives, right?
Yes.
He goes off and does more audio adventures.
Yes, of course. Yeah. And I think the Doctor and Frobisher do too.
Plenty more with the Penguin. So, yeah, I mean, overall, Spiral Scratch is a strange piece of work. Some of it seems very elaborately plotted. There's some intersecting Doctor Who timelines where you see one version of the Doctor show up before the second version of the Doctor knows what's going on. Mm-hmm. Then later you'll see that from a different point of view. There's a whole show-off-y chapter where you see the same party, but from a different character's point of view, and in an alternate universe where some of the characters are aliens. So Gary Russell recycles a lot of the same sentences that he used in the earlier chapter, but can now modify them for kind of comic effect or whatever it is. Very fun.
Had it been more of that, I would have liked it a lot more, but there was just too many different other things going on.
And so
on top of that,
so much of it does seem to be, in contrast to this, just made up as it goes along.
Mm-hmm.
Like the character Monica turns out to be the evil lamprey, but there's absolutely zero indication of that throughout the first half of the book. And there's even a scene between her, Monica, and the grandfather, while no one else is watching, just the reader is listening to their conversation, which doesn't seem to fit with any revelation that we understand later. It's literally as if they changed their mind about what was going on or who the bad guy was halfway through the book and recast it. Editorial interference? I have no idea. Yeah.
And Joseph seems weird, too, because when he's first introduced, he seems very much like a brave, strong character. And then suddenly he's a weak man who's having an affair, and he, after that point, seems very cowardly and weak throughout the rest of the novel.
That's the main reason I say that this book is a hot mess. Not because it is ambitious and kind of fails a lot of the times, but because it seems to be going in one direction and then it's not going in that direction at all. But I'm glad that a book like this exists.
Me too.
It says something about the level. I like the level of obsessive continuity, even if it doesn't produce particularly good works of art. I just kind of like watching people jump through their own self-created hoops.
Yeah, I mean, well, alternate universe stuff is just one of my things. I just kind of like seeing weird little gratuitous throwaway things to alternate universe stuff, and pretty much any story that has an alternate universe element to it, I'm going to be positive about.
Well, that's interesting. That's kind of a chasm between us, because I hate alternate universe stuff.
Really?
Yeah, because I think it drains any sort of real drama. Are you supposed to care about the alternate universe or not? Here it, you know, it deliberately makes a point of that. So I didn't have the same.
So an alternate universe Pat would love alternate universes, ironically.
Oh. I guess I'm thinking more like Earth 1 and Earth 2 in the old DC comics.
Yes, but they can't all be Crisis on Infinite Earths.
Because
that was so good.
Let's do a Crisis on Infinite Earths podcast. So, final verdict, very readable.
I don't mean to sound stereotypically Minnesotan, but you know, it's an interesting. I don't know if I would say it's my favorite Doctor.
Oh, well, you know what I have to say to that, Calvin? Screw you, bitch.
All right, that's our show. Please join us again in 2 weeks when we're going to be talking about The Last Adventure as the second part of our double-length Death Zone, Doctor Who booze pairings, Gallifrey in general. We've had some reader questions about Gallifrey. And finally, we know you've all been waiting for it, our round The Deadly Assassin, in which Kelvin will take on the Moon Dragon and kill the moon. So until next time, I'm Pat.
I'm Joshua.
And I'm Kelvin.
And we're saying,
get out of my world.
I'm being followed by a moon dragon.
Moon dragon, moon dragon.